This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Dirty Rich Cinderella Story, written by Lisa Renee Jones, performed by Aaron Mallon and Joe Arden.
Chapter 1. Lori. The first meeting. With an envelope in my hand and a garment bag to change clothes, I hurry inside the high-rise luxury building of Cat Summer. Cat being the pen behind the popular Cat Does Crime column, as well as a New York Times best-selling true crime writer that I've not only become part-time research assistant to, but who has turned out to be an amazing friend. Rushing through the luxurious lobby, I pass the security guard, who now knows me by name, and wave. A short elevator ride up, and I'm at her door, knocking. She opens the door in jeans and a t-shirt, with her blonde hair piled on top of her head. I hand her the envelope. That's all the information you needed on that shady PI that was working for the prosecutor in the Milton case you're writing about. I motion to my bag. I need to change and get to my day job. I'm running late. Of course, she says, hurrying back inside to allow me room to enter. Come in. And my God, Lori, I can't believe you finished this research already. I knew it had to get done, I call out, hurrying down the shiny hardwood floor and turning right before entering the bathroom to the right of the stairwell. I quickly tow off my keds, peel away my jeans and t-shirt, pull on a black pencil skirt, a black silk blouse, and a black jacket before loosening my chestnut hair from its clip. I grab a chunk before I brush it and confirm that yes, thanks to my 2 hours behind the bar of a coffee shop, I indeed smell like the essence of coffee yet again this morning. I brush out my hair, spray it, apply lipstick, and then finish off with a few pumps of jasmine perfume that seems to be the only scent that dilutes the coffee smell.
Was the door for me?
I hear Reese, Kat's hot, hunky husband, call out. Apparently home rather than at work, but then he works at home often, I found, because he's working on his second co-written book with Kat. It's Lori, Kat calls out. Once I'm done, I zip my bag back up, and now I'm ready for my research job at a law firm that at least gives me casework that is interesting. I exit to the hallway and Kat calls out, in the kitchen. I cut left and enter their stunning open living room, wrapped in windows, and turn right into the combined kitchen. This is incredible work, Kat says from behind the gray granite island. I want to talk about you doing more for me and about Stanford. I would love to do more work for you, but Stanford has to wait. You were top of your law class with 6 months to go when your mother had her stroke. She's recovered. She's gone back to work. And we have $100,000 in bills, living in a crappy apartment our bills forced us into. But I don't say that. It's the one thing I haven't shared with her as we've bonded these past 6 months over chocolate, popcorn, and long nights working. I really have to get to work, but I love you. You know I do. And I'm excited for how this project will turn out. Can you come by tonight? She asks. I really want to talk to you. Reese is having merger meetings here at the house, so we'll have to go to the bar, but they have great coffee and cinnamon rolls. Reese is merging his company? An old school friend of his moved to Texas to take over his father's massive firm. He's in town, and between the two of them, they're plotting world domination. They're meeting alone this morning and then having advisors here tonight. Considering your husband is one of the top criminal attorneys in the country, that's huge. And yes, I'd love to. My mother is working tonight, so I don't have to worry about waking her up. Sounds like I'm not the only one trying to get you a life again. I'm going to work, I say, picking up her cup of coffee and taking a sip, because nowadays it takes me about 3 cups in the morning to get to noon. That's good. You could be the coffee queen behind the counter, I tease before heading toward the door. We're going to talk about the coffee shop tonight. She calls after me, but I don't reply. She's going to delve into my finances, and I can't go there. I don't want to be her charity case. I might work for her, but we're also friends, and I want to stay friends. I head out of the apartment, and it's not long before I'm in the lobby, preparing for the short 3-block walk to my daytime office. I exit to the busy street and round the corner when I smack right into a hard chest. In any city other than New York City, a hard chest might sound pleasant, but here, hard could be dangerous, dirty, or just plain mean. With the impact, I jostle and drop my garment bag, and while I intend to pick it up before it's trampled by the glut of morning walkers, I do not. Instead, I suck in air with the realization that there is a big hand on the waist of my skirt, and my palms are planted on a chest on either side of a blue Burberry tie.
Are you okay?
He asks, probably because I'm leaning into him like I can't stand, not away from him as he's obviously a stranger. Yes, I reply when I should move, but instead I blink into intense pale blue eyes, framed by slightly wavy, finger-tousled dark brown hair. I'm fine, I add, which is an understatement, considering he smells like sandalwood, musk, and man, and I'm having the most sexual experience of the past 2 years of my life on the street with a stranger. Oh, God, what am I doing? I'm okay, I say again, shoving away from him, aware now that he's not only tall, broad, and in an expensive suit, he's handsome, cheeks chiseled, eyes not just beautiful, but intelligent, like half the men I went to law school with, but somehow unlike any of them, which I can't explain in my mind in this moment, so I don't try. Seeking the safety of my bag and senses, I squat down to grab it, only to have my morning destiny stranger do the same. He stares at me, and I don't move. I just squat there, in the middle of a New York City sidewalk, which could be dangerous, not to mention dirty. But I'm rattled, and I don't get rattled. Kat was right. I was top of my law school. Back then, I wasn't a coffee queen, but rather the queen of taking down men just like him. And yet I'm still not moving. Move, Lori! I scream in my head. I need to get to work, I say, reaching for my bag, but it's too late. He grabs it, and when I begin to stand, he catches my arm to help me to my feet, heat darting up my arm, and Lord help me, across my chest. I actually think my nipples tighten. Okay, I don't think they do tighten. I don't have time to recover before I find myself captured by his probing, compelling stare once more.
Let me buy you a cup of coffee,
he says, in what is more a command, really, than a question.
I did run into you, he adds. It's the least I can do.
I'm pretty sure we ran into each other, I say, and he's still holding my bag and me. Why am I letting him touch me? You don't owe me anything, and I have to get to work. I go for my bag. He holds on to it.
How can I reach you?
I run into people at this very corner a few mornings a week, I say with an awkward laugh that is also not like me at all. See you tomorrow? Wind blows my long brown hair into my face, and to my horror, among other more intimate physical reactions, he brushes it from my face.
I'm out of town tomorrow,
he says, his full, arrogant, sexy lips curving while his blue eyes spark with amusement.
How about tonight?
No, I say, because it's the right answer. For me. For my mother. For now.
Then when?
He presses. Another morning, I say, stepping back from him, freeing myself of his touch when I really don't want to be free at all. But my life doesn't allow a distraction like this man could easily become. I really have to go, I add firmly, grabbing my bag and sidestepping him and then darting away in between two people and then to the center of what feels like a huddle of bodies. I look over my shoulder and just like that, my stranger is gone. It's for the best, and yet I have the gnawing sense of regret, like I want a do-over that I shouldn't want at all. It's not time for hot men with blue eyes and hard bodies. Correction, intelligent blue eyes. They were intelligent, and brains make beauty sexy, but that's irrelevant. I will not be meeting him on that corner again. It's done. I can't go back, even if I wanted to. Chapter 2. Lori. I end my day job in the center of a file room of a law office that is established and respected, but unlike Kat's husband, the partners here don't want to grow. Therefore, they don't need someone like me to be more than I am at present, a clerk. For now, that works for me. I don't want to be at a firm that might represent my future when I can't give it all that I have to give to become a success. I simply can't work 80-hour weeks for a limited income to pay my dues right now. At least I'm learning with every case I research here and with Kat. I'm staying fresh. I am staying ready to be on game when I return to Stanford, or finish at NYU, or whatever I have to do to just get that degree. With the offices already dimmed, I store my garment bag in a closet at the back of the file room on my way out. I just don't have it in me to carry it to Kat's and then on the subway home tonight, because while Kat lives near my workplace, my mother and I cannot afford a place anywhere near this neighborhood. I exit the building that is on the opposite side of the courthouse from Kat and Reese's building and start walking, dialing my mother as I do. She answers on the second ring. "How are you?" I ask. "Stop worrying about me," she chides. "I'm feeling good." "It's only your first week back to work," I say. "I hate they put you back on night shift." "I'm just glad to be back," she says. "It's time for you to get back to you." "Not yet," I tell her. "I'm working late." "You work early and you work late," she says. "We need to talk about you, daughter. We're going to the next time I can actually get us in the same house." First Kat and now my mother, I think. "I love you," I say. "Let's leave it at that for now, okay?" "I love you too," she whispers. "So much, honey. I gotta go." She hangs up, and I slide my phone into my oversized Coach handbag that serves as both briefcase and purse. A gift from my father when I started Stanford.
"It's not a Louis Vuitton," he'd said, "but it's a start. You'll have to buy the Louis with all the lawyer money you'll make."
He'd been a contractor who'd worked us up to middle-class New York City with a healthy college fund that made my partial ride to Stanford enough to get me in. Only we weren't as well off as I'd thought. He died of a stroke 6 months before my mother's stroke, which she is thankfully recovering from, and even with his life insurance, it left us nearly bankrupt. I start replaying those days in my head, and it's not a good place for me, not a good place at all. I'm strong, but every once in a while, like now, it's quicksand, and I don't even realize I've finished my walk until I'm standing in front of Kat and Reese's building. Inhaling, I mentally step out of that pit of hell. My father is gone. I can't change that. My mother is healing. Another 6 months and I'll get back to school, even if it's not Stanford, and at least get a diploma. I run my hands over my black skirt and ensure all is in order, tugging on my jacket for extra measure. Then I do what I do. I step out of one world and force myself into another. I open the door and enter the lobby, glancing at the time on my phone that tells me I'm on time. I cut right toward the bar and enter the dimly lit, rather cozy spot that is usually a madhouse of attorneys and courthouse personnel, which is why Kat and I have never once visited together. At the present 8 o'clock hour, however, it's calm, only a cluster of random people scattered around the circular bar in cozy leather seats. Kat stands up from a corner table and motions me toward her. She's dressed in a red suit dress, when a day at home for her usually means jeans. I weave through tables, and I have no idea why, but I have butterflies. It's Kat. This is my job. She's my friend. Unless she wanted to talk about my future and now she's firing me. I almost laugh at myself. That's insane. She's not firing me. Where did that idea come from? And she certainly wouldn't dress up to fire me or do it in public. "Why are you all dressed up?" I ask, settling at the table with her. "Because 15 minutes ago, Reese called. He's at dinner with the CEO of Mellotag and wants me to join him." "As in the CEO of the biggest tech company on the planet?" "Yes, the same CEO that Reese represented when he was accused of murdering the CFO, when it turned out it was the CFO's wife. He apparently finally decided he wants to write his story. He wants me to co-write it with him, but he's headed out of the country and wants to see me now."
"Oh, well, yay, and this," I say, gesturing between us, "can wait.
Except I have something to tell you, and I couldn't wait. You're firing me." She laughs.
What? No, are you crazy? Why would I fire you? God, I wish I had time to find out why your head is in the place it's obviously in right now. But instead, let me give you something better to think about. What kind of better? I have to talk fast, so bear with me as I just rattle off a ton of information. I nod, and she continues. There's a legal consortium that picks the brightest of the brightest to receive a full scholarship award that includes school, living expenses, and a paid internship at one of the firms sponsoring the consortium. There's a rotation between firms, so you won't get a choice. It's like a draft of sorts. The process to get picked is rigorous, probably 6 months, but Reese is good friends with one of the key board members. We recommended you. They're very interested in receiving your application. I blanch. I can't breathe. Then I think I'm breathing too heavy. It sounds wonderful and I'm honored, but I don't think I could afford to take it. Living expenses in these types of programs usually aren't enough, and the internship is the same. Low pay. I can't. It comes with a lump sum of $100,000 split in half at the beginning of the program and the end, and you only have 9 months of school left. My hands flatten on the table. Oh my God. I know. It's wonderful. They only pick one a year though, but we're going to make it you. Surely they want to pay that $100,000 out over 3 years, not 9 months. Actually, she says, the first reaction was really positive. They'd be investing in someone who has a proven track record at an Ivy League school, but they'd want you to finish at Yale, so you'd be a short drive or train ride from the offices. I have more details, but I have to go. Yes, okay. Have I told you I love you? She smiles. I love you too, woman. We stand up and she hugs me. My mom died of a stroke, she whispers in my ear. My father almost did. She leans back to look at me. Soul sisters, we were meant to meet, and this opportunity is meant to happen to you. Eat dinner, on my tab, because I owe you for that research you did this morning, and take a to-go order to your mother. She doesn't wait for a reply. She rushes away. For a moment, I just stand there, taking it all in. And then I sink down on her side of the table against the wall to allow myself to see the rest of the bar. A waiter appears and I order a white Russian when I should order coffee. I don't drink well. I'm too tired and too much of a lightweight. The waiter moves away and I have no idea why, but my eyes lift across the bar where a man is standing up to leave. The man with him, who I cannot see beyond a glimpse of an arm, rises to his feet as well, and they shake hands. They speak for a few moments that become a full minute, and my drink arrives. I tear my gaze away, attending to the waiter before lifting my beverage. The man I'd been watching, or I believe he is the same man since I'd only seen his back, walks toward the door. For reasons I can't explain, I set my drink down, and my gaze slides back to the other man, only to have my eyes collide with his, my lips parting in shock. It's the man from the street this morning. We sit there, staring across the room at each other for what could be seconds, or perhaps a full minute, before he stands up and starts walking toward me. I was wrong this morning. He's not gone, and this isn't over. It's only just begun. Chapter 3. Lori. Tall, dark, and lethally good-looking, with an air of power. That's this man, who's now set his sights on me. I watch him close the space between us, his stride long and calculated. A panther on the prowl, hunting, and I'm the prey. I am not sure there is a woman on this planet that wouldn't want this man's attention, even if she felt obligated to decline for whatever reason. Until this moment, here, now, somehow coming together with him 2 times in a span of 12 hours, I would have thought I was one of those women. But something has shifted in the air today. Something has changed in me, in my future. I feel it. He stops at the table, and he doesn't ask if he can sit. He just does. He cleans the chair across from me, and the heat in his eyes tells me he plans to claim me with it. Cole, he says, and his voice is still rough, deep masculine perfection, and if anything, the charge between us is more powerful than this morning. Lori, I say.
I thought you couldn't do drinks tonight, Lori.
Maybe I just didn't want to do drinks with you. His lips, which are full, beautiful lips that I shouldn't be looking at, quirk at the sides.
Is that how it is?
He asks, amusement in his blue eyes. I haven't decided, I say, because he's a man who consumes a woman, and I can't afford to be consumed.
Then I consider that a win.
How is that? I query.
This morning you said no,
he points out.
Now you're not sure.
How are you even here? I ask. People don't run into each other two times in a day. Are you stalking me?
I could ask you the same question.
That's not an answer, I point out.
I have business in the area, and my days tend to turn into nights.
What type of law do you practice? I ask.
Am I that readable, or do you just know the area of town and assume I'm a lawyer?
Both. He arches a dark brow.
Really? I'm that readable.
Really?
Then tell me what you see.
He orders, lifting my glass and drinking before offering it back to me. The question and the offer of my own drink that he's intimately taken it upon himself to share represents his challenges to me. One, am I really as good at reading him and people as I've indicated? And two, am I willing to entertain where this might be leading? And the thing about a challenge is, I like it. I miss it. I haven't felt it beyond the drive to just survive since leaving Stanford. I haven't let myself feel a lot of things in a very long time. Reading people really is my thing. I take my glass from him, our fingers brushing, heat sparking between us so sharp it's like a bittersweet blade that cuts, and you somehow want it to keep cutting. I lean back and drink, assessing him like I would an opponent in a courtroom, like he does his opponents in a courtroom. He settles against the leather back of his chair, waiting. His expression is unreadable. You're 35, I say, setting my glass down. Criminal lawyer, Ivy League school, trial experience with a high win ratio, mid-sized firm, partner, successful. He leans forward.
Do you know who I am?
Should I?
You tell me.
He presses, a sharpness to him that wasn't there seconds before. Let's revisit that list of what I know of you. I've now decided that you're more successful than I thought, and arrogant enough about that success to believe that everyone, including a random stranger, knows about that success. I don't know you. I don't know who you are. I didn't come here for you.
But you're staying for me?
No, I'm staying for me. But the truth is, if he's someone I don't know but should, this could be a mistake. I've worked where I worked and avoided mainstream legal affairs to preserve my image, to ensure when I put my best foot forward, I put it forward right and solid. I should leave, yet I'm still sitting here, letting him study me, assess me, touch me without touching me because that's how intense the pull is between us. He stares at me for a few beats, and instead of confirming anything I've said about him, he assesses me.
You're 27, Ivy League, fresh out of law school and think you can rule the world.
Somehow he sees the person I was, that I want to be again, but I'm not that person. If I go home with him to a hotel or a home or whatever, I'm not the person he thinks he's sleeping with. I'm not this person. I don't want to pretend to be her. I want to be her, and until I can, I won't. Don't you have a flight or something in the morning?
Yes,
he says, watching me closely.
Which means we better make tonight count, don't you think?
He doesn't live here. He can't become a complication. He can't hurt me. And yet I'm still not the person he thinks I am. It shouldn't matter. It won't matter when we're naked, but tomorrow it will. I know it will. I should let you rest. I stand up, grab my briefcase where I've also stuffed my purse, and I don't wait on him. I dart away, and damn it, I can smell him, that same evergreen musky male scent that just makes me want to roll around in it and get lost. I exit to the lobby and dart right when I would normally go left. I've just turned the corner to a quiet, deserted street to cut back to the subway when a hand catches my wrist and I whirl around to find myself facing Cole.
What just happened?
Now I think you really are stalking me, I accuse, while the heat where he grips me rides up my arm and over my chest.
Call it what you want, he says, but I'm not letting you run again when we clearly want each other.
You really are arrogant.
Yes, I am, but I'm also not wrong. I'll be back next week.
I don't want to know that, I say. I don't want to know you. He arches a dark brow, the moonlight catching on the renewed challenge in his eyes.
No?
No, I say, but even to my own ears, I do not sound convincing. I do want to know him. It's just the wrong time, the wrong place. Suddenly, though, his hand is at the back of my head, and he's stepping into me, his big body framing my body, and then this stranger's mouth, this gorgeous stranger's mouth is now on my mouth. His lips are firm, demanding, and yet somehow a gentle seduction. He's kissing me, tongue licking into my mouth in a deep, drugging stroke, followed by another. I moan softly, and any will I had to resist is gone. I sink into the taste of him, drinking him in, and he tastes like cream and whiskey and sin and satisfaction. I melt into the hard wall of his body, and he is so damn hard everywhere. And yet this is the easiest thing I've done in months. The smell of him, that evergreen musk and man scent consuming me, drugging me. I don't want it to end, and my fingers close around his tie, and for these moments, nothing matters but him, this, now. He rotates me and presses me against the wall, and I swear I want him here on the street, when that's ridiculous. I don't want time to think. I don't want time to find logic again, but that won't be easy to do anyway. His lips have left mine, but he's caging me. His powerful thighs framing mine, his fists on the wall on either side of me.
I'm going to take you home, and then you're going to give me your number so that we can arrange part two of that kiss.
Reality. Now he's trying to bring me back to reality. I don't want to go there, and while I'm not a shy person, I go far bolder than is my norm. I don't need to be seen home, I say, and if you want to fuck me, why wait?
Never rush anything that feels good and different.
I'm not different.
And yet you are. And I don't do different. I just fuck and move on. Yet I can't seem to want that to be this. I can't not do this.
You don't know me enough to say that.
I want to know you.
He says those words low, almost guttural. Why?
There's the question I need answered. Do you want to know me?
No. I lie, despite hating lies. He leans in close, his hand back at my waist, scorching me, branding me, his cheek against my cheek.
Liar.
He whispers by my ear, and that whisper, his warm breath on my neck and ear, shivers a path through every inch of me. My hand goes to his chest, and I can feel his heart thundering beneath my palm, radiating up my arm. I don't remember ever responding like this to any man ever in my life. Certainly not the one I'd once thought I'd love. But this isn't love. This is just plain lust. This isn't about knowing you. He pulls back and looks at me.
And yet it is. Where do you live?
I'm not telling you. He studies me several intense beats and then takes my hand.
Come with me.
But he doesn't move. He waits for me to agree. Where?
To fuck. Isn't that what you want?
Chapter 4. Cole. I have no idea what the hell this woman is doing to me, but I want her. I want her in a bad way, in a different way than I want most women. In that way, I only want to win. In that way, I want a verdict in my favor. In that clawing, burning me inside out while I wait for the outcome kind of way. Like I've waited for this woman, fought for her, given everything for her as I do my work, when I've only just met her. You aren't answering. I press, giving her no room to run again, to back out, forcing her to make a decision. Isn't this what you want? To go someplace? To fuck?
Yes,
she says just as softly, her eyes meeting mine. No blink, no hesitation to her reply, and yet there is more to her answer.
That's what I want?
It's a simple answer, but there is nothing simple about this woman. She's a puzzle I want to solve, and I'm clearly aroused as fuck by puzzles, because I'm 10 degrees of hard and hot. I'm also one wrong word or move from never getting the chance, which is why I push her for a firm decision. Say it then, I press. Say you want to fuck.
Why wouldn't I say it?
Why aren't you saying it? I challenge. Her eyes sharpen and she leans into me, soft curves against every hard part of me. Who wants her softer and me harder? She closes her hand around my tie and tugs gently.
I want to fuck and nothing else. No conversation, no getting to know each other. And we use a condom because I don't do this kind of thing, and I'm not going to make it life-changing. So if you don't have one,
I cup her head again and kiss her. Of course I have a condom.
Because you're a man-whore?
She taunts. I'm no man-whore, sweetheart, I say, and it's true. I fuck when I want to fuck, but I don't welcome the distraction of a needy woman when I'm in the middle of a trial.
And yet you're well-stocked while traveling with condoms.
If she were anyone else, I'd simply say yes, but I want more than that fuck from her, when I never want more than a fuck. And so I play quid pro quo. I give her something. She owes me something. My father put one in my wallet when I was 16 and told me to replace it every 6 months one way or the other.
Because your father was a man whore?
Actually, I say, my voice hardening. He was that and a bastard, nothing I ever want to be, but nevertheless, the condom was a good lesson. Never make one night ruin your life. Right, sweetheart? Her eyes narrow on me, and I realize I've done what I never do. I've given her a piece of information about myself, what drives me, what motivates me, that I give no one. She knows. She's smart. She's sharp. She sees people. She sees me. Before I can analyze how I feel about that, she says, right, and cuts her gaze, telling me that she hasn't just seen more of me than I let most see, but that I've seen a piece of her, some open wound that my own wound has torn at. She wants an escape, not confinement, and while I want to know why, I know I have to wait. I can't drive and push and corner, which is my nature. Not yet. Not now. I slide a finger under her chin, studying her. But whatever was there is gone. Let's just focus on ruining each other for the night, I suggest.
You think you can ruin me in one night?
I'd like to try.
That's interesting, she says.
What's interesting?
I thought you'd declare victory already,
she replies. Why do anything that easy? You're not easy. You're a challenge.
I ran, and you have to catch.
She assumes. Maybe, I say. But you're standing in front of me and I haven't caught you yet.
Then why aren't we walking?
We are, I say, drawing her hand into mine and setting us in motion. A few steps forward and my fingers slip between hers and I bend our elbows, inching her close, our hips aligned. Not about to let her escape.
Where are we going?
She asks. The Four Seasons?
2 blocks?
She says, confirming by her knowledge that her frequenting of the courthouse area isn't a one-day-and-night circumstance. This is, as I'd assessed, her world, while up until present day, or near future, rather, it's been mine only on occasion. But she'd nailed me. Age, career, attitude. I am arrogant. I have to be. It's survival of the fittest. The wind lifts around us, and her perfume is something almost smoky and floral, addictive and unique, like everything about this woman. And she is unique, despite the fact that I've known ambitious, intelligent women in the legal field. I've fucked women that should feel just like her, but that simply isn't the case. She's layers of secrets I want revealed. I'll analyze why later, after we fuck. Or maybe I won't. Fucking tends to put things in perspective. As my father said when he gave me that first condom, what you want when you have a hard-on for a girl is rarely what you want when you pull out. Crass, and ultimately as pathetic as he was, but he was right. Sex has a way of distorting reality and then punching it right back in your face. We crossed the street, bringing the hotel into view, and without a conscious decision to do so, when I never do anything unconsciously, I tighten my grip on her hand. She's already bolted once. I'm not letting her bolt again. We approach the front door, and thankfully the doorman is attending someone else, considering Lori appears to want privacy. Anonymity. I don't waste any time guiding her toward the elevators, and once we're inside, I stick my card into the slot to set us in motion. I snag her hand and walk her to me. Her hands settle on my chest. We stand there, the floors dinging by, the air charged between us. But we don't speak. She doesn't ask me a question. Not about the hotel. Not about when I'm coming back. Not about who I am. Somehow, I know she knows that quid pro quo I've started. Every question she asks allows me to ask one of my own. I don't push her now, not with cameras in the elevator. That's not what people like me do. We save our dirty business for private places. And this is going to get dirty, in all the right ways. I'll ask my questions, and I'll get my answers. When we're inside my suite. When we're naked. The elevator dings, and then I lean in and kiss her. A gentle, barely there brush of lips on lips, our breaths a warm puff between us that turns to fire and heat. Come on, I say, taking her hand, guiding her down the hallway until we stop at the penthouse suite I've been calling home for nearly a month. The place where I plan to strip her naked in every possible way. I lead Lori to the door and pull her in front of me, my body framing hers as I slide the key into the security panel. It buzzes, and I shove open the door, inviting her to enter, and in doing so, I know that I have a choice to make. Take the edge off and do her hard and fast right when we go inside, or let it simmer. Let the attraction between us burn us alive until we're both about to combust from the heat. She pulls away from me, a sweet swoosh of her perfume teasing my nostrils as she enters the suite. My fingers curl into my fists as I resist reaching for her. I inhale for control and let out a breath before I follow her into the luxury suite, seeing what she sees. Gray hardwood floors, an oriental rug beneath gray leather couches that frame a stone fireplace with floor-to-ceiling windows on either side. A stone and glass table to our left, winding stairs to our right. She stops just outside the line of the living area, and I could step behind her, pull her skirt up and lean her over the couch. My cock presses against my zipper, thick and hard with the thought of it. I'd be inside her in about 30 seconds, which includes rolling on the condom, and she'd be wet and hot and tight. And holy fuck, I've had this woman on my mind all day. This isn't ending that fast. I step to her side, close enough to inhale another addictive whiff of her scent, but not quite close enough to touch her. This is the hotel's version of the penthouse suite, isn't it? She asks, glancing over at me. It is, I say. I've been here off and on for a few months, and it just made sense to be comfortable. She glances over at me. The mid-size firm isn't a mid-size firm, is it? Not that mid-size, I confirm. She rotates to face me. You're rich. I turn to face her as well. Rich is a term that can be defined in many ways, but setting that aside, do I have money? Yes, I have a comfortable amount of money. She stares at me, her expression unreadable, but there is this sharp bite of energy before she turns away from me and leans against the couch, her fingers grabbing onto the cushion. Tense, shutting me out, or rather, trying to. I have a typical guy moment where I consider the answer to her mood by way of how much I want to fuck her. If I repeat the hallway fantasy against the couch, we could be fucking and fucking every thought she has away. Puzzle solved. We are fucking great at fucking together, only that's not the puzzle. She is. I move to stand in front of her, close, but I still don't touch her. Why does me having money bother you? I ask. Her chin lifts, eyes glinting almost defiantly. Who says it bothers me? Me, I say, I do. I felt it in your reaction. I feel it now, I see it in your eyes. You see nothing in my eyes, she counters. Your courtroom read might be good, but my courtroom mask is just as good. We aren't in a courtroom, I point out. We're in a hotel room. My money bothers you. You having money is a non-factor. This is one night. We're fucking or we're supposed to be. We're not proposing marriage. Most women start plotting the wedding when they find out I have money. I can make my own money. My hands come down on her waist while hers immediately come down on mine. A sign that she is out of her element, seeking control that I'm going to demand she give up. Is that the issue? I demand softly, my head low. A lean in from kissing her. You feel competitive? No, she says immediately, pulling back to look at me, her hand flattening on my chest. Not at all. I don't feel competitive. We aren't competing. No, I challenge. No, she repeats. Any second thoughts about coming here? No, she says again. Then you still want me to fuck you? I say. No, she says. I want to fuck you. I laugh because she isn't being bold and sexy. She's playing tug of war. No competition, though, right? That's not competing. It's stating a fact. You can fuck me when I tell you to fuck me. She laughs. You're competitive. And I always win. Not with me. Interesting, I say. Damn glad I didn't just fuck her hard and fast. I'm going to enjoy this tug of war she's playing, and I'm going to make sure she not only enjoys it, but that she wants more. Come with me, I say, releasing her and starting to walk toward the bedroom. My tug, her war.
Chapter 5. Lori. I watch Cole walk away, and I know he's pulling a power play on me. I work with attorneys. I went to Stanford. I get it. I also know that he's intentionally given me the gift of freedom. I'm alone by the front door. I can leave if I want to leave. That, along with the fact that this man is really pure hotness, affects me, makes me not want to leave. Makes me want to stay. Makes me want him all the more. I like that he wants me to choose to be here. I like that I know that while he will battle me for control, that he's also sent me an important message. It's always my choice what I give him. Not that always is an appropriate word. This is about tonight. One night. And tonight it's my choice. I force myself to take my time in making that choice. He's in the legal profession. He's well established in that profession. He's powerful and rich. He could know people that I know, and that could damage my reputation. But he's also in a hotel. He's not from here. He's not of the New York legal world. And thinking that we'd actually meet again is certainly possible, but why would it matter to him? He is rich and powerful, and I'm a fresh face with no power or control, not in that world. I can do this with him tonight without consequence. This is not a problem, and it's been so long since I've been with anyone, and I've never been with anyone like this, with no tomorrow and complete freedom. Tomorrow I'm back to all work and no play. Tomorrow there is no him, which means I better do everything I might ever want to do with him and to him right here and now. I choose to stay. I choose to do this for me and to follow him. I push off the couch, pick up my bag, and walk to my right, following the path he's created. This leads me to a hallway that presents a set of steps, because obviously this place needs another set of steps. It's all bells and whistles, displayed in thousands of square feet, in a city known for closet-sized everything. The steps are stone, the railing steel, and the panels between the two are glass. Fancy. Expensive. I grab the railing and start the upward climb, my heart thundering in my ears as I do. I'm nervous, and I really don't get nervous. Law school did that for me. A lot of things did that for me, actually.
Life just doesn't have a lot of patience for nerves and the hesitation that comes with them. I reach the next level of the suite, and there's only one open door. Inhaling, I enter the bedroom to find myself inside a huge master with a huge bed and a gray headboard directly behind it to my left. Beyond that massive bed is a sitting area, complete with a teal-blue couch and two matching chairs. Cole is on the couch, an oval gray coffee table in front of him, and on top of it is a bottle of wine with two glasses. I don't let myself inhale or prepare myself for what comes next. I embrace the moment, round the bed, and stop on the opposite side of the table, setting my bag down on the floor beside it. He's standing, towering high and broad by the time I arrive.
"You stayed,"
he says. "You thought I'd leave?"
"I considered it an option."
"I don't feel competitive with you," I say, "not professionally." That firm, sexy mouth of his curves.
"But when our clothes come off, all bets are off."
My cheeks heat and I laugh. "Something like that?" I almost revert to pre-law school and add, "I guess," but cut it off. I know better. Indecisive words tear away your control and your power. His eyes darken, smoldering with heat. So much heat that I can barely breathe.
"Why are you over there?"
he challenges.
"You can't do something like that or anything at all from there."
He's wrong. I can admire the fact that he personifies tall, dark, and good-looking, but why would I? Why am I over here when I could be there? "You haven't invited me over there," I say.
"I didn't know I had to."
"You do," I say, trying to turn my hesitation into my control.
"Then I am."
He holds out a hand to me.
"Come over here."
My belly tenses in anticipation of the touch he's invited and that I plan to accept, but I do not hesitate. I want him. I want this. I reach out and rest my palm against his, warmth darting up my arm and over my chest, tightening my nipples. He closes his hands around mine, and for a moment, we just look at each other. And maybe I just want to live a Cinderella fantasy tonight, but it feels like something passes between us, something that trembles through me in some indescribable way.
"Come over here,"
he orders softly again, and while I do not like being ordered around, there is a rough, affected quality to his voice that I like very much. He guides me around the table, and when I'm there with him, between it and the couch, I'm once again aware of just how tall and broad he is. It's a fleeting thought lost when his hand slides under my hair to my neck.
"We don't have to do this,"
he says.
"We can drink wine and I'll take you home, or you can stay here with me and when I get back."
"Not when you get back," I say. "Now, tonight, just tonight."
"You say that, but I sense
that I've never done this before." I press my hands to his chest. "Do you make a habit of this kind of thing?" He laughs.
"I'm not a man whore. Stop calling me a man whore."
"Do you want me to leave?" I ask. "Because you left me down there and keep giving me opportunities to change my mind."
"And you took 5 full minutes to come up."
"Do you want me to leave?" I demand again. His hand caresses my neck, his mouth lowering, breath warm on my lips, lingering there a moment before his tongue strokes deep, and he kisses me, a deep, drugging, over-too-soon kiss before he says,
"Do I taste like I want you to leave?"
"You taste like trouble," I say, the pure need I feel for him when I've disallowed myself that feeling for so long is dangerous and yet addictive.
"I am,"
he assures me.
"But that's my job. You are not my job. You're
a one-night stand," I say before I can stop myself, before I let him say something more that makes me forget that this is my Cinderella story, and Cinderella has a night, just a night. My prince is later, if ever. My glass slipper is my mom living, not dying.
"You're Lori,"
he says, brushing his lips over mine. And with that, he's torn down that protective wall I've just placed between me and him. He's made sure he knows who I am, rather than allow it to be about what I am. It shakes me, and arouses me, and when I might turn and leave, because it shakes me all over again, he kisses me once more. God, how he kisses me. A deep, drugging, curl-my-toes kiss that leaves me breathless when his lips part mine, and he releases me to shrug out of his jacket. I am all about touching Cole. Ready for my fingers and my tongue to explore this man every which way, but I have learned from my past, from another powerful man, a man that was a mistake. But I learned from my mistakes. I know when to push, pull, and hold back in ways I once did not. And so, for now, I wait on Cole. For now, I just enjoy watching him, observing him, admiring the flex of his muscles beneath his fitted white shirt as he neatly folds his jacket and sets it on the arm of the chair. It's the message I was waiting on, the read on him that I understand easily. He's all about control, and no matter how much I have declared it to be mine, this man is intense. He's powerful. He's demanding. The kind of man who will demand, take, push my limits, the kind I would run from if he had my name, because somewhere down the road he could be trouble. But I'm in control no matter what happens tonight, because there is no tomorrow. Which is exactly why when he reaches for his tie, as much as I want to help him take it off, to press my hand to his chest, I do not. That would tell him how wet I am right now with anticipation. And I am. How hard and tight my nipples are pressed against the bra that I know will soon be gone, replaced by his hands. Because I'm not giving him that knowledge. I'm not giving him control. He folds the tie, just like he did the jacket, and once he's neatly set it on the armrest, he straightens and fixes me in a blue-eyed stare that says, "Take off your jacket." My sex clenches with that silent command, because despite my designed control tonight, some part of me is ridiculously aroused by the idea of his control. Some part of me also knows that the more I challenge him, the more he will demand. I realize then that there is more to this night than me simply wanting an escape. There is me craving the battle of wills with a man like this one, the adrenaline rush of battling an equal and winning. Or at least not falling. For the first time in what feels like forever, Cole is giving me that rush, and I had no idea how much I needed it. And so, I push back. I don't take off my jacket. I kick off my shoes instead, my toes curling in the soft pile carpet beneath the table. In an instant, I've won. I make him come to me. In one stride, he's in front of me, but he doesn't touch me. Which is his power play. He stands there, a sway together from touching, and I have no doubt that he knows he's suffocating me with the anticipation of that touch. The spicy, masculine, perfect scent of him assaulting my senses. Our eyes meet, a collision of heat and a battle of wills, a challenge between us that I cannot even fully define, but it's there, a crackle of electricity with a life of its own. It lives, it breathes, it drives this night, or at the very least, the here and now. Seconds tick by in which my hands want to reach for him, in which my nipples pebble and ache, heat pooling low in my belly. I'm back to moments before. I'm back to the list of wants. I want his hands on my body. I want my hands on his body. I want to lick him everywhere. I want him to lick me. Everywhere. I want and I want and I want, and I haven't allowed myself to want in so long. Not anything at all. The idea that I'm here with him because I want him, because I choose to be here feels powerful. But the idea that despite all my drive to stay focused on my mission to secure my future and that of my mother's, I'm still here, that he has that much control over me makes him powerful. I love and hate this about him, to the point that despite all the high and rush of the challenge I've professed, I am most likely a little fucked up. But he doesn't give me time to let that idea mess with my head. His hands shackle my waist, and he drags me to him. Are we really doing this? The whole push and pull? I'm enjoying it. I say, my palms flattening on the hard wall of his chest. The heat of his skin hot beneath my touch, seeping through his expensive white shirt and radiating up my arm and across my chest. Aren't you?
I am,
he says, sliding his hand to my hair, yanking away the clasp there, and the instant my hair is free, he tangles rough fingers in the long strands.
And with good reason. I have a plan for you, Lori, whoever you are. Since I don't get a promise of a last name and a phone number,
he says, dragging my mouth to his,
I get everything else.
Everything? I ask, my belly clenching with all the possibilities that word holds.
All of you,
he says. Define all of me.
For this one night,
he says, leaning in, his lips near my ear, the rasp of his light stubble scraping erotically along the delicate skin of my cheek.
I own you.
Chapter 6. Cole. I own you. With those words, my words, my intent in the air and my fingers still tangled in Lori's hair, I kiss her, a deep, possessive kiss meant to claim her, take her, make her mine, if only for this night. And she knows it too, because when my lips part hers, she pants out, "No one owns me." Then, sweetheart, you've never been properly fucked. I slide my hands under her jacket, settling my palms on her shoulders. I guess that depends on how you define properly. I turn her to face in the opposite direction, dragging the jacket down her arms and tangling it around her wrists, and then I lean in close. As dirty as possible, I promise. And with you on my tongue, in as many ways as we both find possible. Is this how you own me? She demands. By binding my arms. As much as I'd like to have you at my mercy, sweetheart, I say, tossing the jacket aside and turning her to face me. I'm selfish enough to want your hands and mouth fully available in any way, shape, or place you choose to use them. I walk us backward, toward the oversized chair made perfectly for the kind of hot, wild fuck in our near future, before my hands fall from her waist. I want to watch you undress. When do you undress? She challenges. We have one condom, sweetheart. Let's make it last. Undress for me, Lori. Her teeth scrape her bottom lip, and for just a moment her eyes cut, but not before I see the flicker of nerves in her stare. And right then, I know that I've read her accurately up to this point. I know that her control is both a necessity and a wall that protects her. I know that no one has made it safe for her to leave those things at the door. No one has ever seen her really, truly naked, and the only way that happens is to do exactly what I'm doing. Push her out of her comfort zone, pull her into the moment, where she forgets the walls, and lives nowhere but here in the moment. That's the place where nothing exists but the two of us. Her eyes meet mine again, and I see the decision in them. She's not going to run like she did on the street tonight. She unzips her skirt and caresses it down her slender but curvy hips. It pools at her feet, and she kicks it aside, allowing me to admire her long legs in lacy thigh-high hose, my gaze catching on the slender strip of lace in the V of her body. Her fingers catch on the hem of her blouse, and she tries to hide the small, inhaled breath of courage she draws before pulling it and her loose bra over her head. She tosses it and stands before me, creamy pale perfection in nothing but silk and lace, her breasts high, full, nipples puckered to a pretty pink that will soon be in my mouth. You're beautiful, I say. Come here.
Quid pro quo,
she declares.
I'm naked, you're naked.
We're still doing the push and pull, but I don't mind. Not when my mouth is soon to be all over her body, which means her mouth will soon be all over my body. I don't want her kneeling before me unless it's to put her mouth on my cock. That's not my goal, not this time at least. It's to own her. And that means she is so damn present, she can't think, she can only feel. That takes trust, and I decide to meet her halfway. I sit down and take off a shoe, showing it to her before setting it down.
So now I get a socked foot?
She teases, and I can feel a hint of her tension easing away,
her comfort in her own skin begins to settle into place. I can feel her easing into me and the night, letting me glimpse the real woman, not the stranger. And I find